Good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm a wife, mother, grandmother, educator, licensed marriage and family therapist. Clearly, I'm my own producer. And we spend each Tuesday afternoon from 2 to 3 talking about those things in our lives that challenge us, that delight us, that we struggle with, and that make our lives interesting in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. And I also clearly have a new guy in the booth this week, now that we've said goodbye to Jordan, who is off to greener pastures. But new guy, what the heck?
Sorry, I didn't have my intro script ready. It's been about a year and a half since I've done it, and I forgot that was the one piece I'm missing. Hopefully that's all.
No, that's all right. Yeah. Hopefully, actually, we're going over the air, and then it will be fine.
Right.
Welcome back, Brian Lanzone.
Thank you. It's great to be back. Happy to be here with you again.
I know. This is so fun. I feel like, you know, one of my limbs was missing for the last year and a half.
Well, it's nice to be back and see your face and hear your voice.
Thank you. And it's, you know, things have changed because, of course, I've added grandmother to my introduction.
Right. And congratulations.
Very exciting. And now you are not a father of a baby any longer, but a full-grown toddler, right? Preschooler?
Yeah. It was a newborn last time I was talking to you, basically. Now he just turned 3 a couple weeks ago, running around singing, dancing, playing instruments, playing with toys. And
that's so exciting.
Yeah.
Well, it's fun to see, you know, how quickly things change, and I don't know, how life just like continues reinventing itself for us, that we think, you know, we always think we're at the pinnacle, right? We always think I've made it to that place, or I'm finally where I wanted to get to. And then, you know, things just keep changing and switching. And I think the whole key to life always is, you know, how well are we able to go with the flow?
Yeah.
And the thing that's funny about not having the intro, and I think it's in my box, by the way.
I checked really quick, but I was rushing.
Is that this weekend, my husband and I went down to Santa Barbara to the Arlington Theater and saw String Cheese Incident play.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know do you remember them?
Oh, yeah, okay. From the 90s, really.
Yeah, thank you.
I was listening to them back then.
Well, so it's funny, I don't know if many people know this, but my opening song is a song by Kyle Hollingsworth, who is the pianist for String Cheese Incident.
Wow, that does not sound like the String Cheese Instrument.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, Kyle, I love his music, and he does these side projects. And when I first started the show, I mean, this is 8 years ago, right, when I used to be on Issues and Ideas, just my little talk, my friend Mark Hughes, right before we started, I said, oh, there's so many little pieces to put together. And he showed up at my house with the CD. He goes, this is the song you should use for the show. You'll love it. It's Kyle Hollingsworth. And I said, okay. And listen to it. And it's been our theme song ever since. So, of course, we're at the show on Saturday. And my husband keeps elbowing me and saying, you should go up to Kyle and tell him that you use his song on your show. And I go, yeah. And then maybe String Cheese will come on and talk about touring and the mental health stress of being a musician.
Right.
And then we got over our fantasy and finished our beer. And so it was fun. But anyway, it was a fun weekend. And I'm glad we played the song a little longer because it's a really cool song, cool bluesy song. So the other thing this weekend is I was tooling through, basically procrastinating from the things I needed to be doing, like grading my papers, because finals week is this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I came across KQED, which was doing their pledge drive, I guess, and they're doing a special about the Carpenters. Now, you're much younger than I am, but do you remember the Carpenters?
I do. I remember them being a band, and remember the female singer being a really good drummer, and that's about all I remember.
Okay, good. Well, and it's funny because so Karen and Richard Carpenter were brother and sister, and loved their music in high school. As a matter of fact, my babysitter that I had, I had two babysitters when I was young, so younger than high school, probably in elementary school and junior high, and they were college girls. And I remember them coming to our house to babysit together and bringing Carpenter's records, and then they'd play all these songs and then talk about their boyfriends. And so there's this whole thing about marriage and love and boyfriends, and the Carpenters are all intertwined for me in my memory.
Yeah.
And so move ahead a few years, the Carpenter song We've Only Just Begun was like the quintessential wedding song for many, many years in the late 70s, early 80s. And in another life, I actually sang that song at a few of my friends' weddings, which is a horrifying thing to remember. I definitely, it's like singing was not my forte, but for some reason, I went through a period of time where I thought I was going to be part of Heart. So anyway, so the Carpenters, so I got really engaged in watching this special And it was also heartbreaking because if you don't know the history of the Carpenters, Karen Carpenter was a phenomenal drummer, but her voice was just incredibly clear and beautiful, beautiful voice to listen to. And she died tragically at the age of 32 from anorexia nervosa, which at the time, no one knew. No one talked about it. I mean, it was just like it was not something that I didn't think medical professionals really paid a lot of attention to. But it's interesting because you would imagine that there's psychological implications, right, of the pressure she must have been under growing up and being – clearly she and her brother were, you know, gifted entertainers and, you know – felt a lot of pressure to perform. And then for her, you know, that perfectionism, anorexia, body image issues, body eating disorders have a lot to do with control and the sense of needing to be perfect and perfectionism and not having an outlet for that, you know, trying to be in control of things that feel out of control. And so as much as she loved performing and maybe she didn't enjoy the pressure of being on stage, that all, you know, kind of, she had no outlet for it, and she ended up dying because she didn't eat. And so here we are today. This was, I don't know what year that was, and I already forgot the date, but let's say 20-something years later, we know a lot more about eating disorders. We know a lot more about body image issues. And the sad part is we know a lot more because they haven't declined. They've actually increased. We have an epidemic level of body image issues, eating disorders. And, you know, where eating disorders at one time were strictly the, you know, something considered a woman's disease or a woman's issue, it's no longer just related to women. Even though 90% of eating disorders are connected to women, we see a growing number of men, young men, who have eating disorders. And I'm throwing out a statistic, and I'll find it. But what's a concern is that when we look at young women and young girls, there are three common mental health complaints that we see in young women and young girls, so ages 10 to 25. And the three most common mental health complaints are eating disorders, body image distortions, and depression. And so it's disturbing to me that we have someone like, you know, Karen Carpenter, who's a high-profile celebrity, you know, brings to the world's attention anorexia nervosa and body image issues, and now we are 20-something years later, and we're in even more trouble than we were before. At one point, you know, we used to see most of the eating disorders starting at ages 12 and up, and now we see girls as young as 10. Showing symptoms of anorexia.
Wow.
Now there's girls as young as 5 or 6 who talk about their fears of being fat. 30 to 50% of adolescent girls report dieting at one time or another. Body image distortion or body image issues and dieting and self-loathing is so common in adolescent and pre-adolescent girls that researchers and therapists have dubbed this body hate, this loathing, as a normative discontent, because the self-hatred is so universal in young women that we can't even see it as a disorder that needs treatment. We just deem it a normative discontent. It's just part of the passage of being a young woman, is to dislike your body that much.
Wow.
But yeah, it's frightening.
It is.
And so the other piece of, and the thing that I was going to focus on this week was an article that came out from UCSB, my alma mater, Go Gauchos. Did you know that I was a gaucho?
I did.
Well, so there you go.
Mentioned on the show before.
Go Gauchos. So UCSB, there was an article that came out talking about the BMI, which is the body mass index, the vaunted measure of our health. And anyone who's gone in for their yearly physical has, I'm sure, heard that those numbers or those letters, the BMI, and tried to find out what their number was. Well, new research has revealed, and it was between UCSB and UCLA, and I'm also a Bruins household, go Bruins, revealed that millions of Americans have been labeled overweight or obese based on their BMI, but are actually perfectly healthy. Actually, 34 million Americans, according to this study, are considered overweight because of their BMI. But they're not only healthy, they're healthier than 30% of those people who are considered in normal range based on their BMI, who are actually unhealthy when you look at clinical indicators. So what are we doing here? I mean, that's astounding. You know, if our BMI, this measure of health, is flawed, considered in the article the death knell for the BMI, that it should be thrown out completely and not considered. If it's been flawed and wrong for how many years as it's been, you know, in the medical industry, and you think of the millions of Americans who have been, one, body shamed and felt ashamed because their weight wasn't in the normal range for their BMI, but then think of all of the unhealthy measures they've taken to try to get their bodies down to the appropriate number of the BMI. And now we go back to this whole issue of body image distortion, body loathing, unhealthy diets, and eating disorders. It's like right within the mid-level of our healthcare, right in the central focus of our healthcare, the BMI has actually in many ways been the main problem in one way or another in propagating or escalating body image, eating disorder, diet industry issues for the last 20, 30 years. So that's what I really want to talk about today, is what is going on in our culture where we base our mental health and well-being on a health indicator like the BMI. We ignore our common sense. We ignore our feelings, right? How healthy we feel, what we're capable of doing. We overlook the power of good health and rely on a number that turns out to be flawed in such a way that it not only has put millions of Americans at risk because they are trying to eat less to get to this number, but all the people who thought that they were healthy and at a good weight are actually unhealthy when you look at their clinical indicators. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I invite you to be part of the conversation, 805-781-3875. I'd be curious to know what you think about these issues. How has your experience with the BMI impacted your life, or has it? How about body image issues and what we see in young women and women of all ages? Because one of the things that we've found as clinicians is that although the media has a big impact on how women feel about themselves, the greatest indicator or the greatest predictor of young women's body loathing is passed down by their mothers. That it's how women, adult women, moms particularly, treat themselves impacts how their daughters view their own bodies. And so if you grew up in a household with a mom that was self-critical, always on a diet, always working on her appearance, those values are going to be passed down to the daughters, and it makes it all the more difficult to feel good about yourself. But even aside from that, when we look at the BMI and how it's impacted not just our health, but I think about our mental health, but also who has benefited from the BMI, because the BMI index determines our health insurance costs. So people who are considered 35 or above on the BMI scale actually pay higher rates. And there's a new rule that's being proposed that those with a BMI of 25 or higher could pay higher insurance rates. So they're even lowering the number at which they raise the insurance rates. So we see for the insurance industry, the BMI is a boom, just as, you know, the way we label other disorders are a boon to big pharma. We see for, you know, the health insurance business and for the diet industry, basing people's health on this number, the BMI, really serves these big corporations. And to go on further with the article or the research done at UCSB and UCLA, that they're also, they found no clear connection between weight loss and health improvements related to hypertension, cholesterol, diabetes, and blood glucose levels. That the weight loss itself was not the indicator in improvements in these areas. It was actually the improvement in diet, right, the nutrition, what we were taking in, and exercise. Mm-hmm. That those had a greater, impact on improving overall health than just losing weight. And because the way we lose weight impacts our health, right? If we're crash dieting or starving ourselves, you know, just because the pounds to come off, that puts a lot of stress on the system. I'm kind of fired up about this. I mean, what do you think, Ryan? Had you ever heard that before?
Yeah, I did. I recently heard that the BMI really doesn't track the overall health of the person being measured. And back in 2007, 2008, I was working for cruise ship companies playing music, and they instilled a BMI index for all their employees had to be under the whatever, the 25 or 35.
Yeah, it's 24.99.
Yeah, and they would give you a year to get under it if you weren't under it, and then they wouldn't keep you employed if you didn't match it. And I had a friend that was short, stocky. He worked out, so he was really muscular, but it actually his BMI was too high, and he's like, so I stopped working out and lose all this muscle I worked for. And he was very healthy, but it just made me question the whole purpose of the BMI thing until you just mentioned the insurance companies. And I thought, oh, there's a motive. I don't know.
There's a huge motive.
That's a conspiracy, I guess. Maybe not.
Yeah. So we'd like to know what you think about this too. How has the BMI and body image and diet industry impacted your life? What do you think about this? 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can be part of our conversation in numerous ways. We have our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, and I post our shows each week. We have our website, TheReluctantTherapist.com. You can send me an email to Elizabeth@TheReluctantTherapist.com. I always read them. I appreciate the feedback. I love hearing from listeners, especially those hardworking moms who are so busy cleaning floors and taking care of kids that it's hard to break away and make a phone call. I appreciate that, but I love hearing from you. You can also podcast our shows by going to iTunes and looking up The Reluctant Therapist and subscribe right there, and our shows will be downloaded into your devices and you can listen at your convenience. So we're talking today about health, in our physical health and our mental health and how the two are interconnected. I started off talking about this new research out of UCSB and UCLA revealing that the BMI, the body mass index, which is calculated by dividing a person's weight in kilograms by the square of the person's height in meters, and then looking at several other markers like blood pressure, blood sugar levels, and cholesterol, and then determining whether or not this individual is healthy. The research has found that this is a flawed index and that it really is actually mislabeling individuals. And I connected that to our epidemic levels of eating disorders, you know, anorexia nervosa, bulimia, binge eating, and our body image shaming and how young women feel about themselves. And I'm curious to know how this has impacted you. At 805-781-3875. Hi, Connie, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Elizabeth. Hi, Brian. How are you today? Hey, Elizabeth, I teach a basic nutrition class for Hancock, and my basic comment is that the BMI is just like that rough screening. It's the first easy number to get, and it doesn't tell the whole story, like exactly what you're saying. So it's like a blood cholesterol screening. It doesn't tell you what your HDL and LDL and all that is. So as a rough screening, it only tells you a first level of information. It's never meant to tell the whole truth. So, and we shouldn't put our mental health in the hands of a stupid number, right?
Absolutely.
So what I like to say is we all deserve to eat well. And the eating disorders, you know, are just such a big trouble. because it's people not believing that they should or deserve to eat well, mm-hmm. and they don't plan to eat well. And so you go all day without eating, and then, you know, what's available to grab are the things that are not the healthiest foods. So we have lost sight of planning to eat in this culture.
Well, and Connie, you brought up a great point, too, because I talk in my classes about how much better food that's created for us is for how better, how much more, how, I can't speak all of a sudden, how better food that's home cooked tastes because of the love that goes into preparing the food, and how wonderful it is for our mental health to take the time to prepare food for ourselves and for our families, that there's some incredible mental health benefits in the actual handling of the food with love and care and serving it.
And we don't have to be gourmet.
No,
in
I'm
my
not.
Family, the rule is peasant food is good food.
Oh, I love
so
that.
So simple, you know, to the point you spend, you don't have to spend 2 hours making dinner. It can be 20, 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you can have something wonderful for the family to sit down to that costs a lot less than going out for fast food, right?
Well, but I wonder sometimes, again, I think we'll have to do a whole other show about access to good quality, healthy food, right? I mean, for some people that is a huge issue, is having access to food that, you know, sustains us. Because if you look at a dozen eggs is, you know, $4.49 in some places, and you can get, you know, four Big Macs for the family. I mean, that's, I think, a whole nother conversation. But I love your earlier point to, you know, for a lot of us, I think the disconnect between our bodies and food is so great because there's such a negative tie-in between food and getting fat that we don't enjoy anything we do eat, that we're just grabbing and going and trying to pretend like we're not even actually eating.
Right, and everyone deserves to eat good food. Sit down and eat good food.
Thank you, Connie. I agree. and it's true. I really believe that the love that goes into preparing food gives the food an even greater nutrition value, because if you think of ourselves as energy bodies, right, if we are emanating energy all the time, then if your loving energy goes into, even if it's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for your child, and you say, I love my child, and you're making that sandwich, you're imbuing that love into that sandwich, and that nutrition is going into your child, not just the food nutrition, but the love nutrition. Just a thought. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. Hey, Clark, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, Elizabeth. I just wanted to echo your sentiment about Karen Carpenter. I really didn't like the group. I was a real rocker, and it was too schmaltzy for me. But I remember, you know, I heard that she passed on. I was curious, and I read about the story, and it made me weep. It still does. I just think, it sounds like an awful suffering she had to go through, and some kind of empathy comes up in me for her. And it struck me back then, and I was out there chasing girls. It was my chasing girls time in my life. And I really discovered by knowing about Karen that many women had this trouble and that they really didn't feel attractive. And it made it real hard to have a relationship with them. I mean, I have my own body issues. I've been skinny, and my BMI is on the wrong side, the other side. But, you know, the women that I really cared about often wouldn't really be able to take my caring for them very well because they didn't think they deserved it. That's how I saw it, and it really hurt me a lot. So I wanted to say that.
Now, Clark, thank you, because that is one of the really unspoken parts of our whole relationship with our bodies and with food and with the BMI and with size and the diet industry. I mean, it's all interrelated, and it comes down to our primal desires to connect with others, right? In these profound ways to have deeply meaningful relationships, and how we connect with our bodies is intricate, right? Is integral in that. And so there, you know, and I grew up in that generation of women, and I don't think it was just started with my generation of women. I think my mom's generation started taking diet pills, and I know the women in the 1800s were taking diet pills, and whatever the social construct of what was considered beautiful, you know, impacted women's feelings about themselves. But, you know, I think one of the greatest harms of our media-driven culture is that it's given us less of an opportunity to just enjoy skin-to-skin experiences.
Yeah. And I remember the movie, watching that movie, Killing Us Softly, so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it really lit me up to exactly what's happening, that there are so many messages that teach, well, women and men to not feel good about themselves, so we'll go buy a product to fix it.
Right.
And it hurts me personally. I see that.
Well, and I think that one of our greatest jobs or missions or goals in life is to heal our own feelings of shame and discomfort in our body so that we can model that to the next generation, because that's the only way, you know, if we've gotten into this mess because we've modeled this shame for younger generations, the only way out is to model a different story. And speaking of models, Clark, did you see the new Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition?
I didn't. I don't usually look.
I know. Brian, would you admit that you looked at the Sports Illustrated?
I didn't. I haven't. I normally don't. Maybe I'll see an ad for it somewhere.
But. Well, so the cover, I don't know if it's a cover model, but one of the models in the issue this year is a size 16 plus size model. And for those of you who don't understand sizes, but for women, you know, generally, I think anything under an 8 is considered normal, which if you know women's sizes, that's just crazy. But yeah, anything under 8 is considered normal. And consider that there are women that are a double zero, like below a zero in size, they're a double zero. So when you get up to 8 or 10, all of a sudden it's considered plus size. But I digress. But yeah, this woman is beautiful. Her name is Ashley Graham. She was actually in an ad last year that ran in Sports Illustrated, and about, you know, full figured women and, you know, curves are in. And it's interesting, they had a size 12 model in last year's issue, Robin Lawley. And if there's a little glimmer of hope out there, it might be, you know, starting to normalize and seeing women's shapes in different ways, right? The media and the world has to start showing these sacred women's figures in different sizes so that we start to revere our shapes in all different ways. I mean, and you know, Barbie released their new body sizes the last couple months, where they have women in different shapes and sizes. So there is kind of this movement towards a different ideal. And I think that's really powerful, especially for someone like me who grew up in the era of Twiggy. I mean, my whole teen years were influenced by Twiggy as the standard for what women should look like. And my group of girlfriends were all really tiny. And so we had, in junior high, was a sewing class, and I was so envious because all the girls were making halter tops out of bandanas, and I couldn't have had like one halter on a bandana at that time, and I was so envious, like, oh, why can't I be, you know, why can't I wear a bandana top? And everyone, you know, that was considered the normal, and so I spent, you know, all of my teen years feeling too big, too large, and I was an athlete, and I was strong, and I was healthy, and going into my 20s, just a lot of body abusive dieting things that I went on back and forth. And it all kind of came to a head years ago, where there was a insurance, goes back to the insurance companies, right? Insurance company policy. And I was considered obese for the policy. And so they were going to charge like an extra $1,500 for the policy because I was obese. And then they ran all the blood panels on me and came back and refunded the money. Mm. And actually my policy was less than the other people in the family because on every other indicator, I was so healthy. And that's when things started to shift for me because I started to, you know, feel better. But until we have a multi-faceted perspective on what beauty looks like, I think things are going to continue to be tragic for young women and young men. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We are talking about the BMI and the flawed research report that just came out, or not the flawed research report, but the research from UCSB calling the BMI a flawed measure of health. We're talking about body image. We're talking about the diet industry. We're talking about what it is to be healthy and feel good about ourselves. And we're looking forward to hearing from you, 805-781-3875. I think we'll listen to a little of Karen Carpenter, and we'll be back to take your calls.
Mm-hmm. had just begun to live. White lakes and promises, a kiss for luck and we're on our way.
We've only begun.
Before the rising sun, we fly. So many roads to choose. We start
If you're just tuning in and wondering, where did KCBX go? Why are we listening to the Carpenters? Well, because I wanted to honor Karen Carpenter and her beautiful voice and her short, tragic life. Karen Carpenter had a band, The Carpenters, with her brother Richard Carpenter back in the 70s, and she died of anorexia nervosa at the age of 32. And I was watching a special about her and reading research, calling into question the validity of the BMI, the body mass index, and wondering what kind of impact this flawed research, this flawed scaling of what is considered healthy has had on millions of Americans over the last 20 plus years, that it's been used as a measure of our health and well-being. I mean, 25% of men, 25 of the adults with eating disorders today are men, 25%. 40% of men report binge eating. And if you're a man, you also are being marketed an unrealistic body ideal that can't be achieved by any normal human being. Just for example, think about the G.I. Joe, right? When you were young, so 1964, when for some of you weren't even here yet, but the G.I. Joe in 1964, if he was life size, would have been 5'10", had a 32-inch waist, 44-inch chest, 12-inch biceps. He was kind of hefty, you know, muscular-looking guy. Normal range. The current day G.I. Joe, if you've looked at one lately, has a 55-inch chest, a 29-inch waist, and 27-inch biceps. Now, that isn't attainable for any normal guy. And when you look at, you know, young women, the body ideals of the Barbie, and as I mentioned earlier, the Barbies have introduced some new sizes. But the Barbie doll that traditionally has been marketed in a woman's body would be 7'2", weigh 101 pounds, have a 19-inch waist, and a 39FF chest. Now, if that was an actual woman, she wouldn't live. Her body couldn't stand up. Her organs would fail, and she would die. 20 years ago, the average model weighed 8% less than the average woman. Today, the average model is 25% underweight and weighs 98% less than the average American woman. So we have the media coming at us. We have the expectations of the diet industry promising us that this new diet craze, whether it's paleo or Weight Watchers or Optifast or whatever it is, you know, promising that this is going to solve all of our woes. And then we have our own medical profession telling us that if we don't reach this ideal weight, we're not only unhealthy, but our insurance premiums are going to go up. It's like, am I the only person that thinks this is crazy? I don't know. 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And Abaya. How are you?
I'm doing well.
So tell me what's on your mind today.
Oh, yeah, and feel free to skip it if it's not, you know, enough on target.
No, you're with me.
I'm 52, and so I've noticed that the body with my hormonal changes the shape has changed and I've put on weight. Mm-hmm. And my husband is fine. He says, oh, you're beautiful and this is normal. And I can feel I have so much resistance to it. Mm. To the changes that I'm seeing, and I'm eating pretty well and exercising fairly well, and
And he says, just accept it. This is kind of inevitable. And I feel like, no, you know. But I don't know that I want to spend hours a day, you know, in order to resist these changes. I'm really at a turning point.
It is, and I'm a little ahead of you. I'm going to be 55 this month and have felt these shifts and changes the last 5 years. But as you mentioned, your husband is at peace with it, and as is my husband. I don't know why men seem to have a little easier transition period, and maybe it's because I think that men really like the soft curviness of women in ways that, you know, belies what our cultural social construct of beauty is. I think there's something, you know, beautiful in that wisdom that comes with being middle age, and it's reflected in the softness of our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't help when you go to the gym and you see women our age, you know, who are ripped.
And I'm really having trouble with it. I can feel the rejection and almost coming back to what you spoke about earlier. I'm still eating well and all, but I can almost feel the resistance to not eat well and to do whatever it's going to take so the body doesn't keep on this trajectory.
Right.
And so, but I feel like, you know, we have to make that decision to embrace what's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
To accept it and stay healthy. So, but it's a tricky, for me, it's really tricky. It feels the temptation to go towards disliking and the body and feeling like it's even betraying me,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
is there.
No, I so hear you. I mean, because I do not have every perfect day of body love either, which is why this subject was something I wanted to talk about, because we all are feeling the pressures because of the social mm-hmm. messages, because also the changes, right? Which is a whole other conversation mm-hmm. we can have about coming into midlife and what does that say in our culture, right? Are we giving up something? Are we losing something when we move to this space? And so there has to be some feelings of resistance. You know, I'm not ready to go there. But if it helps at all, 3 years ahead of you, in the last 2 years, I can tell you that this embracing of this stage, it all comes together. I don't know if that helps,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
I definitely see, it's not like I'm immune to seeing, you know, these ideals that are put forth on a regular basis.
Right. Right. And I want to, you know, I do teach yoga and I want to live, you know, at the higher place of not being in warfare with
Absolutely.
What is, with
Absolutely.
What's happening. I didn't know if we're on the air.
Yes, we are. You're with me.
In that case, I'm feeling rather shy right now.
Well, I'm glad you called in. I'm glad you shared. And it's beautiful that you're teaching yoga and you'll be modeling this transition to all these people who come to you, not just for the movement part, but also for the guidance in their lives. So I thank you for taking the time to call in.
Oh, you're welcome. And luckily, the style of yoga that I teach is about, it's awareness-based. Has a lot of breathing and a long, deep relaxation, so we're not as worried about, you know, what the body's looking like as much as what it's feeling like. And
absolutely.
So I think that's helpful as I continue.
No, absolutely, and that's an important part, because that's what the research from the BMI, you know, the end of the research project was to pay more attention to healthy eating and exercise and how the body feels and not the number on the scale or the actual weight. So thank you for calling in. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. Our number is 805-781-3875. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air. What's
Hi.
On your mind?
I've really been enjoying your show, and I enjoyed the last comment very much. And I wanted to tell you that I read about a few months ago a book called Skin and Bones,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know if you'd heard of it. It's written by Sherry Shahan, Shahan, and I've got the name of the publisher, Whitman Publishing. And it was all about teenage. It's just like your show is perfect for me to hear today. It was all about teenagers who have anorexia and other eating disorders. And it's not just the girls. It's not just the Karen Carpenters. It focuses on a boy. And it's so important that people realize that boys have it just as much as girls.
Yes.
So your GI Joe comment was really relevant too.
Well, and that's the thing is that the media has become very adept at making everyone feel badly about themselves now.
Oh, you better believe it.
So Sharon, tell me the author again.
Sherry Shahan, Shahan, mm-hmm. And it's called Skin and Bones, and it's just so great. It will really help, you know, adults who have problems or, and I got online and there was a woman who made a video about it, and she had almost died from anorexia, and she said she wanted to just tout this book because it's so relevant. And I watched the video and it brought tears to my eyes. So I just, you know, what you're saying today just fits all into that beautifully. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you for taking the time to call. And I will definitely look into that book. I'm always looking for things to pass along to my students also. Hi, Joanna, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hey, I love your show. And I was just enjoying the listeners talking about the well, especially the first woman talking about, you know, our bodies aging and all of that and how that feels, especially as women, as our bodies are changing. And I wanted to just call in and let people know that there is bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, which is because our bodies do change and we don't have to just go with that. We want to be healthy, right? But sometimes we need help. I mean, we're going to lose hormones as we age. So there's some nice natural alternatives, and not to say we all need to be these, you know, fit, six-packed, 50-year-old-plus women, but we also don't have to just say, oh, this is the natural aging, because it doesn't have to be.
But so, Joanne, I have to ask you, because I'm not a big fan of changing the natural direction or course of our lives. I'm much more about the embracing of, because I wonder, you mm-hmm. know, so you take these natural hormones, bioidentical for the rest of your life, you know, what benefit does it have in the long run? Like, what is the long-term outcome? Your
well,
body still
things.
Ages
the,
and you
the
still
benefits
age.
Of and I agree with you because I'm very much about natural and I try to do everything as organic and homeopathically as possible. But the reality is that we don't have to experience the brain fog that goes sometimes with hormone reduction. We don't have to have that middle, the tire, right, the spare tire that even men experience. And so I just encourage people to look at and it's not just hormone therapy. It's bioidentical hormones because those are the hormones that are naturally occurring in our bodies anyway. So places like Kohana Pharmacy, you know, they offer that, and they have, I think they even have these weekly meetings where they talk about it, and you can go and get your questions answered.
Well, that would be maybe I'll have to have them on sometime to talk about it, because it is something that I never was interested in doing. And I have to be honest, you know, 5 years into it, the brain fog and all those early symptoms are totally gone. I haven't had any of them. And so that's
well,
why
and I wonder. And I'm not a doctor, so, you know, I know that it has been miraculous for me and for so many men and women. And, you know, it's awesome that you aren't experiencing that, but it would be interesting, yeah, to have somebody from there come in and talk about it.
Someone that knows, someone that knows much more than me.
And me.
Yeah, thank you, Joanna, because I do think that it is part of the transition in aging, and that's a whole other conversation we need to have on the air is how we look at aging in our culture, you know, and it's so social that it
right.
impacts our psychological part of aging, you know, and I think that was kind of my fight with it is that I was going to model aging gracefully, whatever that looked like, because I grew up,
right.
you know, I grew up with the generation of women who continued altering their body to try to prevent the aging. And I just said, I'm not going to do it. And I may look like I'm 70 when I'm 50, but I'm just going to let it ride the way it's going to ride out. So I'm really curious about the whole conversation in our culture about what it is to age and how we do that and what our expectations are. So stay tuned so you can call back when
I
we
will.
Have that conversation.
And with that too, I agree with you. But it's not just how we look, because if we don't feel good, you know, that's really what it gets to for me anyway, is looking good is one thing, but if I don't feel good, then you know, I need to do something about that.
Absolutely. So. Nothing else is as fun.
Right.
Thanks for calling in, Joanna. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're welcome to join our conversation as well, 805-781-3875. I introduced the show today talking about Karen Carpenter and eating disorders and anorexia nervosa, and how, you know, we lost the superstar of a talent when she was 32 years old in a time that no one was talking about eating disorders or body image issues. It was the era of Twiggy as the model du jour, and how we are, you know, 20, 30 years later, we haven't come any further in our understanding of how to treat these issues. If anything, we have a greater epidemic of eating disorders and normative discontents about body image and self-loathing, and it's starting earlier and earlier and earlier. Children as early as five and six talking about their fear of being fat. And then now this research out of UCSB and UCLA basically throwing the BMI out as any sort of indicator for our overall health, and the impact that that's had on the 47 million people who have been determined to be overweight or obese, and what measures they've taken and the shame they've felt to try to get under a number that actually was flawed. So what do you think about that? 805-781-3875. Hey, Jen, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Elizabeth. I really enjoy your show, and this one in particular really gets me because I had an eating disorder. I was bulimic for 12 years from the age of 17 to 29, and I have recovered. And I recovered in my 30s, and I've been able to maintain it just by, first of all, really having to accept my body and love my body. And, I mean, I got a lot of help. I was in Al-Anon at the time, and so I got a lot of help from the supportive community. And I am really grateful and feel blessed to have really recovered, because I hear it's not that common really recover from a disorder.
It's not. It's so challenging. And so, if you don't mind me asking, Jen, what do you felt led to the eating disorder to begin with?
Well, I was interested also in your comments about my mother was always on a diet growing up, and my older sister was on a diet, and my mother hated the fact that she was overweight, and I heard those comments. I started dieting at the age of 11 or 12, and it was just a way of life for the women in my family. But then my mother also developed alcoholism during my teen years, and things got much more chaotic. And about the time she was the most unstable, my older sister introduced me to throwing up as a way to deal with overeating. And I just continued that for 12 years.
And as I mentioned earlier, quite often the eating disorders erupt from this need to feel like we're in control in chaotic and out of control situations.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That I can control the food intake. I can control my size.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets out of hand.
I started first trying to be anorexic because that's a little more glamorous.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't work for me. And so the bulimia just took off, and it was a daily practice for 12 years.
And so tell me what you most enjoy about your body and food today.
Well, at the time I was also a dancer when I recovered started my recovery. And what I most disliked was this hatred of my body rather than appreciation of what my body was able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had to really challenge and I found a few other people, and we just started to develop appreciation for my body because I could dance. I mean, and I could see people who couldn't even walk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I developed appreciation. I stopped weighing myself.
Mm-hmm.
I started just eating what I wanted to based on the concept of, do I really want it or not?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a kind of a saying that I would eat for hunger, nutrition, and pleasure. And I was even in my 20s, I was even bulimic on like brown rice. Mm-hmm. I could eat very healthily and still be bulimic.
Mm-hmm.
But I carried on being healthy and also allowing myself to have treats when I wanted them. I just had to ask myself if I wanted to. And over the course of about 2 years, it took me to really stabilize and be able to feel like I could eat whatever I wanted to. And today I eat three meals a day. I have, you know, cookies, you know, maybe once a day, or ice cream or whatever, if I want it. And I've become very attuned to how my body feels and what feels good and what doesn't feel good. I exercise, and I just really want to be healthy rather than thin.
Beautifully said, Jen. Thank you so much for taking the time to call, and I'm so happy for your found love of yourself. And continue
it. Thank you for doing this program.
No, it's my pleasure. And, you know, when I started to talk about the Sports Illustrated and the historic, you know, model, Ashley Graham being a size 16, and kind of this movement slowly in our culture towards the idea of curves being in. Now, you know, don't get too excited, because, of course, when the media says someone's curvy, they might say Jennifer Lawrence is curvy, right? Or they say Kate Winslet is curvy. These women are tiny. You know, they're at the 1-2 size. But when we start seeing someone like Ashley Graham, who's a size 16, and again, the numbers really are not as important as just the fit. You know, shape, beautiful beauty of her shape. If you look at it, I'm sorry, maybe sounding creepy, but I just look at the, you know, the beauty of women in the, you know, medieval paintings. I'm trying to, you know, kind of this Rubenesque, gorgeous, round softness that just emanates health and beauty and serenity. You know, like that is what I would hope would be our ideal for women. And maybe we see this shift with models like Ashley Graham, and that we can only hope, you know, that the social construct of what is in and what is beautiful starts to become more realistic and more broad. And especially in a culture like ours, which is so culturally diverse, you know, women of different cultural backgrounds come in different sizes, and the beauty of the size is what we should focus on, right? The beauty of the shape, the intricacies of what makes us women and men is fascinating. You know, it's, and that's where we should be. 805-781-3875. Jenny, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I just wanted to share some thoughts. As soon as I heard the subject, I thought every woman in the county is going to be calling you. I, too, grew up during the Twiggy hippie era. I'm 59 now. And I say I've always had body dysmorphia because I think, like you said, I was supposed to be the petite blonde with long, straight blonde hair. And I'm not at all. I'm tall. I'm athletic. And with long, dark, curly hair. And so I struggled with that for years, and then did develop bulimia because I was also the perfect child, supposedly. But I'm trying to look at this a little differently, too, as I get older. What helped me get out of bulimia was I needed a place to express myself. So I started focusing more on my inner self, not my looks, because I kind of came to terms with the fact that I didn't think I would really ever look like I felt I should. So I fortunately, I was able to get a home up here and express my talents artistically, which really helped. And I stopped weighing myself. I do work out a lot, so I found I could eat what I want if I work out. And I don't look in mirrors much, just enough to check that things are in place and not dribbling or whatever. But I find you were just talking a lot about how bodies could maybe look with a softer look as you get older. Mm-hmm. I try not to even think about it too much and just more focus on my inner self. Mm-hmm. And what I think is beautiful in a person is a grounded, whole, loving, good person that's got wisdom in their eyes. So I think my focus of beauty has shifted more with at least other people to that, rather than this almost a perfect look doesn't look pretty to me anymore, of, you know, coiffed hair that's dyed perfectly and features that, with no wrinkles. That doesn't look good to me at this age.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up about the internal process, because I often have wondered, all the things, I've often wondered all the things I might have accomplished throughout my younger years had I not been so focused on how I looked, right? If I had, enjoyed.
Yeah, it was like day in, day out. All I was doing was thinking about how I should look and what I could eat and what I could throw up. It was for so long. And it was such a waste of time, but it was something you have to go through if that's your path, or, you know, whatever you're dealing with. But the thing I have dealt with recently is, unfortunately, I had the early gray hair gene, mm-hmm. and I did dye my hair for many years, and I started to think about, boy, I exercise a lot. I've been vegetarian for 40 years, eat carefully. I do have a nice treat each day for my happiness and soul. But I thought, I'm doing all these other things, and I try to have a lot of love in my life and keep well-rounded. So why am I dyeing my hair? What is it that I'm trying to do? And I really liked the way when somebody had mentioned bioidentical hormones and you brought up that you wanted to age normally and not use artificial things. I thought, why are all these women dyeing their hair when we know that hair dye is so toxic? And I even had a friend say to me she would rather dye her hair and die early than not. And when she said that, it really hit me, and I thought, I want to be here for grandkids and a long, long life. And it's so, am I going to be in a coffin with perfectly dyed hair? It just didn't make sense to me.
Jenny, thank you. That's a great way to wrap things up, because as always, our conversations can be many hours long, because there are so many directions we can go about health and well-being. But I just want to leave you today with these thoughts that if our medical indicators are flawed, then how are we going to trust that we are well and healthy? And we have to be constantly vigilant and take responsibility for our mental health and well-being. We can't entrust our mental health and well-being to professionals. We can go to them for guidance, but we have to take responsibility for ourselves. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Please join us on our Facebook page. Go to iTunes for podcasts. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. Thank you for supporting public radio. And we're going to leave today with more music from the Carpenters and Karen Carpenter's beautiful voice, Ticket to Ride.
Said, I think it's today. Yeah. The boy that's driving me mad is going away. He's got a ticket to ride. He's got a ticket to ride. Ticket to ride, and he don't care. He said that living with me was bringing him down. Yeah, he would never be free when I was do right by me. is sad. I think it's today. The boy that's driving me mad is going away. How
he's got a ticket to ride. He's got a ticket to ride. Don't care.